Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 61 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Jobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site and sound broadcasting. Our first article today will be from our November of 2019 issue, because y'all might have been missing the Texanist, and I have been too. So I'm going to read this show today. It's nothing but the Texanist. So we're starting today with the Texanist from November of last year. Offering fine advice. Texanist is a keen observations since 2007. He's senior editor David Courtney. Send him your questions at texanist@texasmonthly.com. Be sure to tell him where you're from. First question today. During a recent trip down to the Big Bend area, friends and I went to a ranch advertised as the best place to watch the Marfa lights. The lights we saw were two distant pinpoints of illumination that maybe moved around a bit. I was underwhelmed, but everyone else was convinced they had seen something unexplainable. What are your thoughts on the Marfa lights? The answer. The Texanist has attempted to view the mysterious illuminations outside Marfa no fewer than a dozen times over the past 30-some-odd years, Mr. Trout, and each time he has also been disappointed with what he witnessed. In fact, the Texanist never spotted anything that he could, even by the longest stretches of the imagination, call the Marfa lights. So you'll forgive the Texanist if he doesn't sympathize with your dissatisfaction. At least you saw something. But did you really see the Marfa lights, or did you merely see some lights in the vicinity of Marfa? As you may be aware, Marfa's famous luminosities have been on the radar of Texans for at least as long as Marfa has been Marfa. In fact, the year of the town's founding, 1883, is the same year in which a young cowboy, Robert Reed Ellison, is reported to have witnessed the lights. Ellison's account is oft noted as the first recorded sighting, although there are tales of Native Americans having earlier witnessed the lights. Since then, the lights have become a major attraction. In 2003, the Texas Department of Transportation even built a roadside viewing center 9 miles east of Marfa on US 90. The oodles of scientific studies that have been conducted over the decades have confirmed a couple of things. Strange lights of an unknown source do occasionally appear outside Marfa, and regular old everyday lights are often confused for the strange lights whose source is a mystery. One of the most dedicated Marfa light researchers is James Bunnell, a retired aerospace engineer who grew up in Presidio County. Bunnell studied the lights for a dozen years, beginning in the early 2000s, and has written 4 books on the subject. Mr. Bunnell, who is 79 years old and lives in the Fort Worth area, was happy to talk to the Texanist about his own experiences with the lights, as well as what you may or may not have seen. Bunnell figures that you likely observed headlights of cars traveling between Marfa and Presidio on US 67, and not the actual lights. The actual lights are a rare occurrence, Bunnell said. If you really want to see them, you have to be very patient. According to Bunnell's research, about 97% of what people think are the Marfa lights are the result of explainable sources, such as vehicle headlights, train lights, ranch lights, low-flying aircraft, Air Force blimps, satellite stars, lightning sprites, a lightning-like flash, trash fires, brush fires, oil fires, fireworks, fireflies, and folks horsing around. Sightings of a number of these things, not including the fireworks, fireflies, and those beautiful stars that the West Texas night sky is known for, could, in the Texanist opinion, leave a person underwhelmed. Mr. Bunnell, in chatting with the Texanist, recounted his first sighting, which occurred when he was maybe 4 or 5 years old. His granddad took him out to see the mysterious Marfa lights one evening, and they did indeed end up seeing some lights, but Bunnell didn't recall the experience as being life-altering and thinks now that what he saw that night was probably just car lights. Years later, though, in 2000, he took his wife out to a viewing area east of Marfa to look for the lights. They were treated to an amazing show. These were definitely not car lights, he said. I was blown away. Not to disappoint you any more than you already are disappointed, but the Texanist is of the mind that if you were not similarly blown away by what you saw, then what you saw was likely something other than the real deal. Thus, your underwhelmed response is perfectly understandable. That question came from Jeffrey Trout of El Paso, and this next one is from Caleb Scarborough of Houston, who asks, from reading your columns over the years, I know that you've lived in Austin for a long time, but if you had to move to another part of Texas, where would you move? Your hometown of Temple, your beloved North Padre, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Marfa? You must have given this some thought. You are correct, Mr. Scarborough, the answer goes. Exodus does indeed currently reside in Austin, just as he has since 1984, when he decided to leave Temple, the town in which he was born and bred, to broaden his horizons at a public institution of higher learning some 60 miles down the road. Capital of Texas is a wonderful place to reside, and the Texanist has no regrets about having toned down stakes there. It has an excellent music scene, great food scene, a spring-fed swimming hole you can walk to from downtown, a college football team that occasionally doesn't break the Texanist heart, and an undercurrent of its countercultural past, which still allows for a laid-back vibe. Texanist has often said that if he's going to live in Texas, and he's always has and always will, he's going to do so in Austin. You're also correct in noting that the Texanist has occasionally given idle thought to life outside Austin. But would the Texanist ever move back to Temple? It's a fine town, especially so now that the never-ending I-35 construction nears its end. And it was a delightful place in which to grow up. There were, after all, woods, a creek, fishing ponds, a drive-in movie theater, two in fact, a skating rink, a Sonic, and loose rules with regard to openly carrying BB guns. What more could a boy want? Texanist wouldn't change a thing about Temple or his upbringing. But sadly, the Texanist is an orphan of Temple these days. He's got neither people nor holdings there anymore. Thus, the draw just isn't there. North Padre? The Texanist has been visiting this island community's beautiful beaches and salty lagunas since before he can remember. More than 50 years now. It's one of his favorite places, but too much of a good thing, he fears, would ruin the whole coastal getaway aspect of his visits to that sandy paradise. For this reason, the Texanist doesn't think he'd ever want to be a full-time islander. How about Houston? Texanist likes Bay City plenty, and it's always struck by the diversity of its populace, wealth of its cultural offerings, and the sheer bigness of Texas's biggest metropolis. But he couldn't live in Houston for the same reason he's never considered living in Dallas, which he likes for similar reasons. Texanist just isn't a city boy, and his inner hayseed wouldn't be comfortable in either place. Yes, it's true, Austin is no longer the quaint hamlet it once was, but that laid-back vibe that Texanist mentioned can make it feel like one in a way that Dallas and Houston just do not. San Antonio? Even though it's now bigger than Big D, the Texanist loves San Antonio, but if he were to ever move to the home of the Puffy Taco, he fears that he would become Puffy himself. San Antonio, home of the Puffy Texanist, doesn't have a very good ring to it. Marfa? The Texanist digs far west Texas. Ever since attending summer camp in Fort Davis, he's had a soft spot for that area of the state. There are a few places in Texas, or anywhere for that matter, that possess such scenic beauty. Mountainous high desert terrain, pleasant climate, mysterious lights, the wide openness of it all. What's not to like? Well, the desolation, perhaps. The Texanist is a neighborly sort, and the neighbors out there, friendly as they are, can be fairly far flung. Texanist doesn't much like the idea of having to make a 20-minute drive just to borrow a cup of sugar, but he salutes those who have chosen that life for themselves. Man, there are a lot of great places in Texas, but another thing about Austin, in addition to its many aforementioned amenities, is that it's also, due to its central location, a perfect place from which to springboard to the rest of the state. Even Texas's furthest reaches are relatively, and the Texanist emphasizes relatively, short hops away. Ooh boy, Texans may need a nap. He's a little tuckered out from daydreaming about so many of his favorite places in Texas, which is to say, so much of his favorite places in the world. But before he stretches out, let the Texans ask you this, Mr. Scarborough. Where in Texas would you choose to reside if you didn't already live in Houston? Now let's turn to our next Texans. This is from December of 2019, our Texans column. First question today comes from John Hancock in Dallas. I'm enjoying a nice beach vacation with my in-laws in New Jersey, and the house just across from us is flying a Texas flag, an American flag, and a New Jersey flag. However, the Texas flag is flying upside down. As a lifelong Texan, what's my duty here? Kindly point it out to these neighbors, sneak over in the wee hours and fix it for them, or just let it go? Answer is, good eye, John Hancock, and thanks for taking time away from your vacation to execute your patriotic duty by alerting the Texans to this flagrant snafu involving the flying of Texas's revered standard. Any Texan worth their salt knows the flag should always be flown right side up, which is to say white stripe on top and the red stripe on bottom, except, and this is important, as a signal of dire distress and an instant of extreme danger to life or property. It's right there in section 3100.053 of the Texas Government Code. This is why, of the three options you're considering, the Texan strongly advises that you exercise option number one. Your New Jersey beach town neighbor, as odd as it may seem, might well be a fellow Texan in urgent need of your assistance. They could be in all sorts of trouble. What if their house has been shanghaied by Snooki and the rest of the Jersey Shore cast? What if former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has commandeered their stretch of beach? Or maybe they're just running low on Mexican martini Texans. Who knows? Thankfully, chances are that your neighbor is not in serious distress and has simply bungled the hoisting of the flag. They wouldn't be the first. One afternoon back in 2012, the Texan was whiling away an afternoon gazing out his office window, which is in the heart of downtown Austin, when he suddenly noticed that the Texas flag flying atop the Ernest O. Thompson State Office Building was upside down. Duly alarmed, the Texanist, not having the phone number to the Ernest O. Thompson State Office Building handy, but knowing that the building sits next door to the governor's mansion, got on horn to the governor immediately. Or maybe he tweeted about it. He really can't remember. Either way, the flag was quickly righted, and the Texanist went home and, after his usual bedtime tonic, slept soundly, knowing that he had done a deed that needed doing. All of this is to say you shouldn't think of the person flying an upside-down Texas flag in New Jersey as a stranger. That individual, as the Texanist mentioned, is likely as not just a fellow Texan in need of a neighborly nudge encouraging them to rectify their bollocked-up banner. But again, they may also be, though the Texanist hopes they aren't, a fellow Texan in need of actual assistance. Whatever the case, if he or she is indeed a fellow Texan, the Texanist trusts that they'd help you out with a flip-flop on the other foot. The Texanist sure hopes everything works out all right. Please report back and let him know, though, he's not going to sleep well until you do, even with extra tonics. Next question is from Scott Bishop at Southlake. I followed my Texas-born and raised wife back to Lone Star State 5 years ago. One of the many things I've learned since then is that there is only one natural lake in Texas. Back up in Washington State, where I come from, there are many such lakes. How did all the other lakes appear in Texas? The Texanist is impressed with how well you've acclimated to the unfamiliar land in which you found yourself. You arrived just 5 short years ago, and yet you already managed to let loose with one of Texan's most pervasive yarns, as well as any Texan the Texanist has ever heard. Did the Texanist say yarns? Yes, he did, for the simple reason that the oft-repeated fact that the Lone Star State is home to but one single solitary natural lake is false on two grounds. In actual fact, there are plenty of natural lakes in Texas, and the lake you surely have in mind, East Texas's Caddo Lake, isn't one of them. Not entirely, anyway. It's a long story, but a few centuries ago, the Red River, which serves as Texas's northern border with Oklahoma before running down through Louisiana, started getting clogged up with fallen trees. Over the decades, the plug grew and grew, eventually reaching more than 100 miles in length. Red River Raft, as this wonder of nature came to be known, was such a massive jam that it caused a great deal of water to back up into the river's various tributaries. One of them, Big Cypress Bayou in Texas's northeast corner, is the waterway upon which Caddo Lake formed. After the raft was cleared by the federal government in the late 1800s, Caddo drained a bit before the outflow was stanched by a man-made dam in 1914, preserving the impressive body of water that both Texans and Louisianans had already started making commercial and recreational use of. In the Texanist opinion, scenic beauty possessed by today's Caddo Lake with its ancient Spanish moss-draped cypress trees is unsurpassed. But is Caddo a natural lake? Well, if you don't look too closely, you can maybe sort of see it that way. But even if we do categorize it as a natural lake, it would not, contrary to popular lore, be Texas's only one. The truth is that Texas has numerous natural lakes. Eagle Lake in Colorado County is at least as natural as Caddo, and so is Green Lake in Calhoun County. Plus, there are Resacas in South Texas and the Panhandle's Playa Lakes. Not counting its deserty western portion, Texas is actually pretty darn damp. In fact, there are about 7,000 lakes made by both Mother Nature and man scattered across the state, majority of them found in the wetter eastern third of the state. Some of these are smallish affairs of the sort into which the Texanist will occasionally drop a badly hooked tee shot, but others are great big bodies of water, like Possum Kingdom Lake, Toledo Bend Reservoir, or Grapevine Lake in your neck of the woods. Altogether, and including rivers and streams, Texas is possessed of enough inland water to rank right up there among the wettest of the lower 48 states. But as you might have guessed, Texas does indeed have a lot of man-made lakes, and you're probably here for a reason. As you've also probably learned in your 5 years of Texanhood, your new home can be unpredictable when it comes to the weather. Precipitation especially can be hit and miss. Sometimes the rain comes in gigantic Texas-sized buckets, and sometimes those buckets are filled with hot wind, tumbling tumbleweeds and dust. To deal with these occasional bouts of flooding and drought, Texans have over time constructed numerous large reservoirs across the state. Most of these came into existence after the devastating drought of the 50s, also known as the time it never rained, which was the title of Elmer Kelton's novel set during this particularly parched period. 100 years ago, there were only 8 major reservoirs in Texas. By 1960, there were more than 100. Today, there are more than 200 dotting the Texas landscape. South Lake, where you live, is called South Lake because, as you probably know, it sits south of Grapevine Lake, which was impounded in 1952 when Denton Creek was dammed. The fringe benefits to drought and flood control, of course, are hydroelectric power generation and watery recreation, which are both nice, especially in the summer. As you now know, it gets hot here. So to sum up, contrary to what you and, frankly, too many other Texans have come to believe, Caddo Lake is not Texas's only natural lake. It may not even qualify as a natural lake at all. The Texanist believes this matter to now be settled. Thanks for the letter and welcome to Texas. May your time here be wet and wild. All right. Next edition here, we have this is January of this year, 2020. It was the Bump Steer Awards issue, but we didn't ever get to the Texanist, so here we go. Still offering fine advice and keen observations since 2007. First question, name withheld. Be leery of those. Texanist, you're hardly a Texan if you're one of those pesky liberals. Would transplantist not be a better handle? The answer, Texanist receives a fair amount of mail. He asked for it right there in the fine print of each column he writes. See it just up there on the right? Most of what lands in his inbox are pleas for assistance with the Texan situation, arcane conundrums of a Texas-y nature, or friendly comments on recent columns. Occasionally, the Texanist gets mail from prison, which can be interesting, and every so often he'll get a rambling, incoherent note from somebody he suspects of being drunker than Cooter Brown. Those can also be interesting. Recently, the Texanist received your brief email, Mr. or Ms. Withheld, and although he isn't able to ascertain precisely what the Texans might have written or said or done that spurred you to send it, he seems to be catching a slight whiff of disgruntlement. So despite the fact that you're in flagrant violation of the rules of writing to the Texanist, you didn't reveal where you are from or even volunteer your name, a response seems to be in order. And that response is, the Texanist, on behalf of all Texans, is greatly affronted by your narrow definition of who qualifies as a Texan. The intensity of his affrontedness is likely due to the fact that as the recipient of piles of missives over the years, the Texanist has had a prime seat to the glorious pageantry that is the vibrant mosaic of Texas's citizenry. At various junctures, the Texanist guesses he's heard from conservative Texans, liberal Texans, moderate Texans, libertarian Texans, pacifist Texans, vegetarian Texans, straight Texans, and LGBTQ Texans, not to mention the occasional lost Oklahoman or curious Californian. And the Okies and Californians accepted, all of those folks had one thing in common. Whatever their political, religious, sexual, or cowboy boot-toe shape inclinations, they were all Texans. As is, it should go without saying, the Texanist. Your crack about him being a transplant is a calumny, just like his forebears for generations, the Texanist is a native. Have you ever noticed that Texas is a fairly sizable place? Well, you know what often accompanies size? Variety. When you've got 29,087,070 notoriously individualistic people living amid more than 268,000 square miles of megacities, charming small towns, and anodyne suburbs, it's pretty much guaranteed that you're going to find a few disagreements between them. And yet we all manage to live in relative comity because Texans of all stripes, not including those who withhold their names and locations, apparently are mostly content to live and let live. It's a philosophy that has held Texans in good stead for many, many years now, and one you would do well to adopt. You see, the logical conclusion of your hostility toward those who you think differently than yourself is something of an absurdity. Do you really mean to suggest that the millions of Texans who identify as liberals aren't Texans? That LBJ wasn't a Texan? That neither the great folklorist and foe of McCarthyism, J. Frank Dobie, nor his antagonist-turned-friend, Amerigo Paredes, were Texan? Nor statesperson nonpareil Barbara Jordan? Nor Ann Richards. For land's sake, Willie Nelson may be the greatest Texan of all time, and on many issues, as you surely know, he is quite liberal. As to whether or not the Texanist is himself a member of that august group, let him offer this brief response. That's none of your damn business, thank you very much. Of course, the Texanist does have personal opinions on all manner of subjects. Sometimes people come to him for just those opinions. Much as it is with the long-held rule of etiquette that deems discussion of religion, politics, and sexuality off-limits at parties, so too the Texanist feels that it is not a very good idea to delve into such topics while working in the advice-giving trade, and so he demurs. In short, you might think about showing a little more kindness toward the Texanist and the 29,087,068 other Texans who share this wonderful and wonderfully diverse place we call home. And if you can't, well, maybe it is you who should transplant yourself, perhaps to a place where the official motto isn't friendship. And our next question today, it comes from Cecil Cole of Austin. It's that time of year again. Temperature barely dips below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. All the TV weather reporters have invariably characterized the condition as a hard freeze. in ski country. And up north, the forecasters simply report 12 degrees or minus 2 degrees without offering any reminder that water freezes at 32 degrees. We Texans are quite familiar with the concept of ice, so my question is, why do Texas weather folks always say hard freeze? The Texanist feels your pain, goes the answer. He was also once of a mind that TV weathercasters were too often overly sensational with regards to the recaps and outlooks, especially during the summer when the Texas weather can become downright monotonous. At times, it feels like insult is intentionally being added to injury. In fact, back in the summer of 2016, the Texanist went off on meteorologists who he thought were talking way too much about the heat index. Todd, can we just leave it at that, pleaded the Texanist? But then some months later, after the arrival of that first blue norther, with both the weather and the Texanist had cooled down a bit, he came to realize that the heat index, which takes the actual temperature and factors in the relative humidity to come up with the feels-like temperature, does serve a purpose, namely increasing the safety and well-being of his less hardy fellow Texans, and he felt a little remorseful for berating the well-intentioned weather folks. The irritation with which you've come to the Texanist is a similar one. But just as it is with the heat index warnings, there is also, believe it or not, a legitimate distinction between a freeze and a hard freeze. Dr. John Nielsen Gammon, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at Texas A&M University, who serves as a state climatologist, explained to the Texans that a hard freeze occurs when the air temperature falls to 28 degrees or lower and then stays below 32 for long enough to freeze vegetation. The significance of a hard freeze as opposed to a freeze is mainly the impact on plants. It's really more of an agricultural concern than a meteorological one, Nielsen Gammon says. See, a forecast that calls for the temperature to hit 32 or 31 or even 29 degrees and then rise back above freezing fairly quickly doesn't present as much of a threat to what are known as the four P's, plants, pets, pipes, and people, as does a forecast calling for the temperature to drop to, say, 25 and then stay below freezing for a good stretch. Whether a person happens to be a produce farmer in a winter garden of South Texas, a rancher in North Texas, or just a homeowner in Bastrop, worried about the health of her toilet drain pipe, a heads up about such conditions can be quite useful. The reason weather reporters in more northern parts of the country are not as quick to use the term hard freeze is simply because the folks up north, with their snow blowers and doggy jackets, are no strangers to such frosty conditions. While it can get mighty chilly here, Texans are often surprised when it gets cold enough to interrupt the year-round growing season that much of our state enjoys, and we benefit from a little goosing when our plants and other peas are at risk. Interestingly, Nielsen Gammon points out that conversely, because Texans are well accustomed to excessively hot weather, the threshold for heat warnings is higher here than it is in more northern areas. This is simply a matter of Texans being able to take the heat, he said. So in a nutshell, while it is true that any mercury level that dips below 32 degrees Fahrenheit is technically freezing cold, there is a real difference between that and a hard freeze. Think of it as the difference in the relative coldness of a well digger's derriere and a witch's bosom in a brass brassiere, or the other way around. Either way, stay warm. It's cold out there. And next up, we turn to the next month. This is February of this year, and this is the Texanist, offering fine advice and keen observations since 2007. The Texanist is senior editor David Courtney. You can send him your questions at texanist@texasmonthly.com. Be sure to tell him where you're from. First question today comes from Marty Reed in Dallas. I've been wearing a Stetson Open Road for at least 15 years now, but I hardly ever wear it these days. Reason is that the Open Road and felt Western hats in general seem to have suddenly become exceedingly popular. Hipsters have commandeered these hats. When I put mine on, I feel like a copycat, which I am not. Have we hit peak Open Road? Texanist answers. Texanist is a man of many hats, and not just metaphorical ones. He wears actual ones, too, including an indestructible wide-brimmed Mexican palm straw and a Gus, the handsome silver-belly lid that's so named because it's a replica of the hat worn by Augustus Gus McCrae in Lonesome Dove miniseries. The Texanist Gus was made for him by famed hatmaker Manny Gamage, the man who designed the original Gus at his Texas Hatter shop way back when it was located off I-35 in Buda, now located off US 183 in Lockhart. You'll be happy, or perhaps upset, to know that the Texanist is also the proud owner of an Open Road. The topper has been in the Texanist possession for 5 years, but his very first Open Road was purchased during his college days in the late 80s at Joseph's Men's Shop, a now defunct old-time haberdashery that is located on Congress Avenue in downtown Austin. For the uninitiated, Stetson's Open Road is one of the iconic hat manufacturer's most iconic styles. It's the model that was found atop the noggin of Presidents Harry S. Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Lyndon B. Johnson. The hat is so closely associated with the 36th president, in fact, that it is often referred to simply as the LBJ hat, or even just the LBJ. It's a classy, subtly Western-style hat that has a 4 1/4 inch crown with a cattleman's crease and a short, for a cowboy hat anyway, 2 3/4 inch brim, with a sharp-looking trim ribbon bound edge, which is the hat's most distinguishing feature. Historically, it's been the perfect hat for the rancher, bank president, doctor, musician, politician, service station owner, shopkeeper, postal worker, elevator operator, railroad engineer, college professor, high school coach, hotel manager, barkeep, and so forth. And it still is today, though there are a lot fewer elevator operators around than there once were. The Open Road's staying power is a testament to its timeless design. It really is a fine-looking hat. The fact that folks, including the gals these days, want to wear one isn't at all surprising. And as for your observation that there has been a recent spike in the number of Open Road hats found perched atop the heads of Texans, you and the Texanist are in complete agreement. You and the Texanist diverge greatly, however, on whether more hats on the heads of more Texans is a bad thing, whether or not the hat wearers in question happen to be artisanal candle makers or ridiculously mustachioed baristas. Texanist is of the firm belief that this is not a bad thing at all. He is not in the least bit concerned that there are too many hat wearers walking around nowadays. No, sir, the way the Texanist sees it, the problem is that despite this recent uptick in chapeau sporting, there are still too few folks donning hats. You ever been to a cattle auction or a small town cafe at coffee time, Mr. Reed? Everybody there is beheaded. Everybody. And it's a Texanist dream that one day the whole of Texas will resemble one of these splendid places. Nothing, in fact, would please him more than to exit his office building in downtown Austin and wade into a sea of hat-wearing Texans, no matter how many tattoos, body piercings, or funny-looking mustaches they may have. Texanist, by the way, is not the only denizen of the capital city who's a fan of cowboy hats. Texas legislature, in all of its wisdom, and really this decision may have constituted all of its wisdom, designated the cowboy hat the official headwear of Texas in 2015, and has found no reason to reverse course on that resolution since. In the same spirit, the Texanists would urge you not to hang up your hat for good. In addition to keeping your head warm in winter and shady in summer, wearing that hat is your civic duty, plus doing so made you happy once and will no doubt do so again. Have we reached peak Open Road for the sake of all that is Texan? The Texanist sure hopes not. Next question from Jason Gallegos of Fort Worth. Had a recurring discussion with people over the past few months about salsa and hot sauce and the difference between the two. Most all of them point to articles they find online that say hot sauce is more like Cholula and Tabasco, while the stuff that comes with chips at a restaurant is always salsa. But these pieces are typically written by people in regions of the country that don't eat hot sauce or salsa on a regular basis. So I've come to you for assistance. Personally, I feel that hot sauce is any type of sauce with a more liquid consistency and spicier flavor, and that salsa has more of a chunky pico de gallo type of consistency. But what say you? The answer. What to call a particular piquant potion as opposed to another piquant potion is a hot topic of conversation around these parts. Is it hot sauce or is it salsa? Question, as you've learned, depends on whom you ask. Here in Texas, we're blessed with an endless variety of both hot sauces and salsas, including, but by no means limited to, red ones, green ones, orange ones, jarred ones, bottled ones, canned ones, and fresh ones, like the mean pico de gallo or pico de cock the Texanist occasionally whips up at home. Among these, there are thick ones, spicy ones, thin ones, mild ones, chunky ones, vinegary ones, and combinations upon combinations thereof. As a small evidentiary sampling, consider the classic Mexican-style bottled hot sauces or salsa picante, such as Cholula, Valentina, and Tapatio, and Louisiana-style bottled hot sauces, such as Crystal, Tabasco, and the eponymous Louisiana. And then, too, there's bottled pepper sauce, the clearest vinegary staple of the southern table. Additionally, Texans are no strangers to chili sauces, such as Sriracha, rooster sauce and the like, as well as Chinese chili oils and the Southeast Asian sambals. And then there are the salsa fresca, such as the pico de gallo and the familiar Mexican-style salsas found in the condiment aisles of our grocery stores and accompanying the baskets of chips at our Tex-Mex eateries. Nearly all salsas we know are, technically speaking, hot sauces. After all, most of them are spicy, and salsa is, of course, the Spanish word for sauce. So to reiterate, a salsa is a type of hot sauce. But that's not what most of us mean when we say hot sauce. Consensus among random Texans, the Texans consulted for this informal poll, is that, as you stated, hot sauces are thinner in consistency and most often shaken onto other foodstuffs, while salsas are chunkier and are usually put to use as dips, such as one finds alongside the aforementioned chips. The complication is that the Texanist has in his lifetime enjoyed numerous spicy blends. He regarded his salsas that were thin and runny as straight tomato juice and has also asked waitstaff on more occasions than he can remember for refills of hot sauce when referring to the stuff that goes with the chips. Does that answer your question? The Texanist sure hopes so, because his head hurts from thinking about all this, and he's really thirsty for another margarita. And it's approximately halfway point of our show. You're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Radio. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, Channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Broadcasting since 1967. We turn now to another Texanist. This one from the, let's see, this is, should be the March issue of this year. Yep. First question comes from Richie Sawyer of Lufkin, who asked, I recently learned that in baseball, a pop fly that falls between the infield and outfield and results in a base hit is known as a Texas leaguer. And now I'm curious about the term's origin. Do you know why a Texas leaguer is called a Texas leaguer? That's a good baseball trivia question, Mr. Sawyer. Thanks for sending it. But as good as the query is, the answer is even better. The idiom, it turns out, dates back to the early 1890s when Ollie Pickering, a native Illinoisan who was playing for the nascent Texas League's Houston Mudcats, made baseball history. On May 21st, 1892, Pickering hit a whopping 7 singles. To this day, the most singles ever hit by an individual player in a Texas League game. The really remarkable thing, though, is that each and every one of these singles was reportedly the result of a weakly hit bloop that found its way just far enough over the infield to drop uncaught into the outfield. So extraordinary was the feat that news of it spread far and wide, and such hits thereafter came to be known as Texas leaguers. A few other accounts of the term's origin exist, but this is the one that Texans finds the most credible and the most fun. And speaking of fun, the Texans thought it would be a hoot to offer an unsolicited, annotated list of other phrases that begin with the magical word Texas. This is not, of course, a complete list, but it's a pretty impressive grouping nonetheless. Enjoy. Texas caviar is a delicious party dish starring pickled black-eyed peas. It was made famous by the famous Texas transplant chef, Helen Corbett. A Texas dip is an ostentatiously deep curtsy performed by Texas debutantes on the occasion of their social entree. A Texas exit is an informal and illegal highway off-ramp blazed through the grassy strip separating a main thoroughfare and the frontage road by Texans with better places to be than stuck in traffic. Number 4 is a Texas rig. It's an advancement in sport fishing developed on Lake Tyler in the middle part of the 20th century, whereby a plastic worm is hooked in an ingenious manner that prevents dastardly snags. A Texas sheet cake, or sheath cake, if you're the Texanist's dear old cake-making mother-in-law, a large, like Texas, chocolate cake that is baked on a sheet pan before getting dotted with pecan bits and sheathed in sweet chocolate icing. Texas toast is bread that is sliced at twice the normal thickness, about 3/4 inch, and liberally buttered or margarined or oiled and then toasted, sometimes griddled, to a golden brown, most likely the 1941 invention of Royce Haley at Beaumont's Pigstand Drive-In Restaurant. As far as toasted breads go, Texas toast is, in the Texan's mind, the best thing since sliced bread of average thickness. A Texas Tommy is a hot dog that's split lengthwise, filled with cheese, wrapped with bacon, and then grilled or fried, as well as the name of a jaunty swing dance. Oddly, the Texanist has uncovered an actual Texas connection with neither and cannot explain the appellation in either case. Texas toothpick, this phrase may refer to a pocket knife made by W.R. Case's Sons Cutlery Company of Pennsylvania, a combination of fried jalapeno and onion strips, or an actual toothpick crafted from the penis bone of a raccoon. To the Texanist knowledge, none have any specific tie to Texas, other than the fact that at various times the Texanist fathers found uses for all three. Now, number 9 is the Texas Towers, which is a set of 3 U.S. Air Force radar surveillance stations positioned off the east coast of the United States during the Cold War, and so named because the platforms were modeled after offshore drilling platforms first used off the Texas coast. Number 10 is a Texas Titty Twister, a purple nurple that has been Texased up a notch by way of additional half-twist. Well, that's 10. Texans could keep going, but he's filled the space allotted for a response to your fascinating query. He had a little more room. He'd mentioned Texas Longhorns, Texas Tee, Texas Two-Step, Texas Stop Sign, Texas Wedge, Texas Catheter, and many more. Thanks for the Texas question, Texas Pen Pal. Next question comes from Curtis Watson of Grapevine. As a native Texan, I have traveled my fair share of the state. Often as I gaze out the window, I've noticed something that puzzles me. What's up with the grills at roadside parks and rest stops? When in the history of Texas travels have folks loaded up for a trip to Grandma's Padre Island with luggage, bag of charcoal, and 5 pounds of raw meat for a cookout on the side of the road? I'm confident you have friends at the Texas Department of Transportation who can help solve this mystery. What gives? And the answer, Texas, as the Texanist has noted before, is home to more roadway than any other state in the country, some 80,000 centerline miles of it, according to the Texas Department of Transportation, the agency that is tasked with the construction and upkeep of much of that blacktop, as well as occasionally assisting the Texanist in his professional endeavors. With all of those 80,000-plus miles of highways and expressways and byways and throughways and this ways and that ways, Texas is, to put it mildly, not lacking when it comes to opportunities for motoring. And just like you, the Texanist loves a good road trip, whether he's hopping over to East Texas for some lake fishing, down to the coast for some beach time, out to West Texas to take in some deserty desolation, or up to the panhandle of marvel at Paladura Canyon, Texanist is always happy to have the opportunity to saddle up and hit the trail. No matter the destination, such sojourning is good for the soul. Sometimes, though, the Texanist is loath to admit he can become so bent on getting where he's going that he can overdo it a little bit with the fervency of his driving. Pupils of his eyes become two tiny specks reflecting a fast-moving conveyor belt of highway stripes. Like Fritz von Erich applying the iron claw to an opponent's cranium, he tightens his grip on the steering wheel until his knuckles turn white. Texanist begins to experience a keen regret over not stopping to relieve himself at any of the past four opportunities. Beads of sweat surface on his forehead. This is not safe driving, and the Texanist is not proud of himself. When the Texanist finally comes to his senses, though, he thanks his lucky stars for his TxDOT friends, whom he did reach out to for you, and in so doing, learned a whole truckload about Texas's safety rest areas, which, owing to their actual raison d'etre, is how they're officially known. The first of these respite spots were constructed soon after President Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Highway Beautification Act of 1965, also known as Lady Bird's Bill, as highway beautification was one of her pet projects. Today, there are 77 such rest stops sprinkled along our beautiful and occasionally not so beautiful waysides, and that's not counting a dozen of the larger travel information centers. Main feature of most of these stops, in addition to the restroom facilities, of course, are the picnic areas, each one unique in design. Who could forget the iconic teepee-style structures found in Lajitas, or the 6666 ranch barn style in Guthrie, or when known as Kitschy Oil Derricks? Now, not every safety rest area features grills, but many of them do, and the TxDOT folks tell the Texanist that these grills are often used not by folks on their way to Grandma's or Padre Island, but by residents of the surrounding communities who often regard rest areas as local parks. The Texanist even learned of one couple who chose to embark on their journey together as husband and wife by getting hitched at a rest stop. Alas, as we near the end of our own journey together, Texanist would be remiss not to reiterate the main purpose of safety rest areas, which is not roadside grilling, but again, safety. Sadly, just as Texas has more roadway than any other state in the country, studies suggest that so too do we have the most traffic accidents caused by driver fatigue. Safety rest areas, it turns out, are very important features of our sprawling road system. Texanist recommends taking advantage of them, and heck, while you're at it, go ahead and pack some charcoal and meat. Roadside grilling is still grilling. Grilling is never a bad idea, especially when it's for safety's sake. We come now to April of this year, and this is the Texanist. First question comes from John Thomas of Dallas. I met a couple from the UK several years ago in Florida, and when I told them I was from Dallas, they said, "Oh, that's where the cattle still roam the streets." They were serious. Shocked, I corrected them and explained that Dallas is very modern, has tall buildings, museums, etc. To this day, I feel guilty for shattering their antiquated view of my city. Was I wrong to do so? And the answer. It's funny how many folks from around the world have never visited Texas hold such charmingly ridiculous misconceptions about it. In this day and age, what with the World Wide Web and the universality of so-called smart devices, it actually kind of boggles the mind. Still, just about every Texan who has traveled outside the United States or encountered foreigners and even some non-Texan Americans inside the United States has experienced this phenomenon. Thanks to Texas's colorful history, which has been extra colorfully depicted in Western novels and radio shows and movies, that everybody in Texas rides a horse and everybody in Texas carries six guns and everybody in Texas incessantly shouts yeehaw and cattle still roam the streets in Dallas. Stereotypes are refused to die. The Texanist can think of no other state as widely and flagrantly misunderstood. But though the Texanist is a card-carrying journalist whose job entails getting facts straight, it is his professional opinion that the pang of remorse you felt over the past few years is not undeserved. For while cattle may not roam Dallas as they did back when Don Ely Bryan launched his Trinity River Ferry business in the 1840s, the tradition of tall tale telling, a tradition first brought to Texas by the Texans' great-great-great-great-granddad, a Republic-era pioneer who introduced Davy Crockett to the sartorial joys of both buckskin and coonskin, does still roam quite freely throughout Texas, spinning a magical yarn or passing it off as the God's honest truth is a Texan's birthright. And you really missed your chance when faced with an audience whose adorable ignorance primed them for a heaping helping of grade A lone star malarkey. Of course, the Texanist wasn't there in Florida and doesn't know all of the relevant circumstances, but regardless, the correct response of the British couple's amusing cluelessness would have been to puff up in pride, crank the twang up to 11, and assume a persona resembling a combination of Captain Woodrow F. Call, as depicted by Tommy Lee Jones in the television adaptation of Lonesome Dove, and John Wayne in most any of his silver screen cowboy portrayals. If they thought cattle still roamed Dallas, there's no way they'd know that Wayne was actually from Iowa. That's right, pilgrims, you might have told them as you casually leaned a badly sunburned arm against a tiki-style bar at Alan Sal's beachside lounge while sipping a frozen drink from a coconut shell with an umbrella in it. Big D is indeed lousy with cattle. Fur's the eye can see. Matter of fact, I'm a cow puncher myself. Heck, fire. Just last week, I was poking some bogeys along Central Expressway during 5 o'clock drive time when a stampede damn near broke out. It was bumper to bumper, I tell you. We'd been a real calamity had I not been able to lasso the Pamela Parched. Who needs another key lime daiquiri? Anywho, as I was saying, well, you get the idea. In short, it is the Texans' firm belief that an opportunity to entertain tourists with harmless tomfoolery should never be wasted. Next time, don't let yourself or the team down, Pilgrim. Next question is from someone who chose to withhold their name, from Midland, Texas. Question: for the first time in a number of years, I find myself with a boyfriend, and I've really been yearning to go on a lovey-dovey getaway with him, but we need a little help. Where is the most romantic spot in Texas? Congratulations on landing yourself another beau, Ms. or Mr. Withheld. The Texanist, a man opposed to lonesomeness, except when it inspires cheer-in-the-beer honky-tonk numbers, is glad your drought is finally over. Between you and him, there have been times in the past when the Texanist's own love light shone quite brightly, and other times when it was reduced to a dim flicker. All of that was a long time ago, however. Texanist is happy to report that he and Mrs. Texanist are coming up on 20 years of mostly blissful connubial enjoyment this very spring. As such, he is quite familiar with the joys of the romantic getaway, and though such trips occurred more frequently in his salad days, and many of those outings are probably not ones he would recommend to a couple today, the Texanist is happy to ensure that you won't be entering another Epoque Sans Amour anytime soon. So let him now slip on his couple's counseling hat, arrange the travel brochures on his desk, and offer up a little assistance. As was just alluded to, time was, the Texans reckoned, that a spur-of-the-moment overnighter in Nuevo Laredo for frog legs and Ramos Gin Fizzes at the Cadillac Bar was the very model of an alluring road trip. Then, too, there were slightly less extravagant excursions to dusty small-town tractor pulls, dustier goat-roping events, and saliva-slathered watermelon seed-spitting contests, which the Texans also regarded as the epitome of romantic travel. Texanist is a little embarrassed to admit it, but he also used to tout La Quinta staycations as fun weekend escapes. It's amazing the Texanist ever found anybody to settle down with him, isn't it? Thankfully, Texas is chock full of romantic settings, some of which even boast a hint of international flair. So how about a trip over to Gay Paris in northeast Texas, or ancient Roma down on the border, or in case you're feeling a little more randy, maybe Sweet Union south of Rusk in Cherokee County would suit y'all. Venus in Johnson County shares a name with the Roman goddess of love. You might try Loving, with a capital L, up in North Texas, or maybe Valentine, way out west. Hey, Sugarland! Texanist is mostly kidding. He just thought it'd be fun to point out a few spots whose names alone were redolent of romance. In truth, he would be able to vouch for only a couple of those places, but all moderately funny dad-joking aside, Texas is actually replete with destinations suitable for your needs. And your timing, the Texanist must say, is impeccable. In his humble opinion, there's no time in Texas like springtime in Texas. Weather is warming, wildflowers are beginning to make their appearance, and love, like the smell of freshly cut grass, is in the air. So all about packing light, heading south to the Big Bend area. You ever been to Marathon? The views are inspiring. A few folks you'll encounter are friendly, and the White Buffalo Bar at the Page Hotel is said to be the originator of the little delicious ranch water tequila cocktail, which, in the Texanist experience, can be as libido-tickling as any Ramos Gin Fizz. Nearby hiking options, if you got the energy, ain't bad either. Texanist might also suggest a trip to the lovely laid-back little seaside town of Port Aransas, where you can kick off your shoes and stroll hand-in-hand in the setting sun as the waves lap gently at your bare piggies. Then you can go out and gorge yourselves on fresh-caught fruits of the sea and trip the light fantastic at a salty dive bar where mezcal body shots are a thing. Or maybe a trip to the big city would suit you. There's high culture, interesting history, good people watching, and debauchery aplenty to be found in Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Austin, Fort Worth, and El Paso. Or how about a real change of scenery for you Midlanders with a trip to East Texas? Lots of tall, tall trees out that way, you know. Lots of pretty lakes for your fishing, boating, and canoodling on the banks needs. Although it was illegal prior to 2011, noodling, or hand fishing, is also acceptable behavior among the banks of Texas lakes and rivers. Texanist once had a heck of a time on beautiful Toledo Bend Reservoir, largest lake in Texas, and there's also Primal Caddo Lake, a body of water so naturally beautiful, well with the giant Spanish moss-draped cypress trees, as to rival any romantic setting on earth. Come to think of it, the Texanist has had some luck with a number of these spots, and he's certain one of them will work out for you too. And just so you know, Midland is home to not one, but two La Quintas. We turn now to another edition of the Texanist. This is from our May issue of this year. First question, wooden stage musical based on the Texas Revolution featuring the likes of Stephen F. Austin, Sam Houston, William B. Travis, James Fannin, Davy Crockett, and Ben Milam be as exciting as Hamilton? the Broadway musical based on the life of American founding father Alexander Hamilton? Question comes from Alex McLennan of McKinney. The answer, the Texanist, who had the pleasure of attending a touring performance of Hamilton last summer in Austin, concurs with your assessment that the Texas Revolution would make an excellent subject matter for a stage musical. As good as your idea is, however, you may not be the first person to be struck by the notion of turning Texas history into the focus of a musical. According to the Handbook of Texas, several plays about the Texas Revolution were written during the early statehood period, including one titled The Storming of the Alamo. Additionally, Texas has, since Governor Bill Clements signed Senate Bill 93 into law in 1979, not one, not two, not three, but four official state plays, and each one is a musical drama with some aspect of Texas history as its focus. The Fort Griffin Fandango, which started in 1938, which is the oldest of the quartet, is put on annually in Albany and relates the history of the settlement of the area along the Clear Fork of the Brazos River near Fort Griffin, a frontier outpost. Texas, written in 1966, perhaps the best known of the foursome, is staged beneath a stunning 600-foot-tall cliff at the beautiful Pioneer Amphitheater in Paladura Canyon State Park each summer from June to the middle of August. Texas promotes itself as a musical romance of Texas Panhandle history. Beyond the Sundown from 1975, which delves into the Alabama and Coushatta Indian tribes' fraught decision over who to throw their support behind when the battle for Texas independence got underway, mounted for a number of years at the Sundown Amphitheater on the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas' reservation in East Texas, and The Lone Star, written in 1977, which was commissioned by Born on the Island Galveston philanthropist Mary Moody Northern and staged at her namesake amphitheater in Galveston Island State Park, also focused on big events of the Texas Revolution. Sadly, Beyond the Sundown seems to have had its last performance in 1983, and The Lone Star appears to have been backburnered since 1990, leaving only Fandango and Texas in regular production. So with only two of Texas's four official state plays still being put on, perhaps the time is right for a sweeping musical spectacular set amid the dramatic doings of the Texas Revolution. One can just imagine the many classic songs that would live forever in the American Standards repertoire. Don't Cry for Me, Matamoros, Santa Ana, Get Your Gun, I Feel Pretty Sure That We're Badly Outnumbered, and of course, the crowd-rousing showstopper, Hello, Baby. Who's going to write those songs, though? Texas would offer to collaborate with you, but he is currently busy thinking about Texas Monthly, the musical, an idea hatched by his across-the-hall office neighbor, executive editor Michael Hall. The magazine's 50th anniversary, which occurs in just 3 short years, is right around the corner, and there's a riveting, melody-filled drama about the travails of a spunky group of writers, editors, and advertising salespeople that has to be flawlessly composed and cast and choreographed between now and then. We definitely want it to be a lot better than Consumer Reports, the musical. Thanks for the letter. Stay in touch and break a leg. Question next up from Herb Bergstrom of Sparta, Michigan. I'm just a poor old guy from Michigan, born and raised on a small city lot, but I receive Texas Monthly and I enjoy it very much. I even enjoy the advertising because it is so classy and well done. I especially enjoy the real estate ads in the back. I guess I kind of fantasize about owning one of the massive ranches I see for sale. My question is, what in tarnation, did I use that word correctly, does a person do with 38,000 acres? It warms the cockles of the Texanist's hardened old heart to learn that a Michigander such as yourself has fallen under the magical spell of the Lone Star State by way of the editorial content of the periodical that has employed him as a lowly scrivener all these many years. The folks over in the advertising sales department will be especially glad to hear that you are also enjoying the fruits of their labors. And the Texanist can relate. He has momentarily lost himself in reveries quite similar to yours while lingering over the very same ads guiding jaw-droppingly picturesque ranch land. It's not uncommon for the unlanded to dream such dreams, after all. Texas, in case you didn't know, comprises some 171,901,440 acres in total, more than twice the size of Michigan, which is half covered in water anyway. 95% of all that Texas land is in the hands of private owners, some of whom are the masters of gigantic spreads, just like the ones you and the Texanist are window shopping for. Many of the state's most famed ranches are, in fact, famed mainly for their sheer giganticness. For instance, there's the half-million-acre Wagoner Ranch up in North Texas, which went on the market a few years ago with an eye-popping asking price of $725 million, and not long afterward, it sold. And then there's the 278,000-acre Coconuts 06 Ranch in the beautiful Davis Mountains in West Texas, and the historic 6666 Ranch, which is part of the 275,000-acre Burnett Ranch's empire, and of course the Crown Jewel King Ranch, which at 825,000 acres of South Texas is bigger than all of Rhode Island. The What incarnation, you deployed the word perfectly, by the way, can a person do with his own 38,000 acres of Texas? It's a great question, but before answering it, the Texanist would like to ask a question of his own. Why in tarnation limit yourself to pretending to be owner of a measly 38,000 acre place when you could pretend to be owner of a ranch more than 10 times that size? Fortuitously, the Texanist recently learned of such a ranch having hit the market out in West Texas. Brewster Ranches, owned by a Kentucky businessman who is reportedly the seventh largest landowner in the nation, covers more than 420,000 acres of ruggedly stunning Big Bend country, boasts two airstrips, running waterways, and mountain peaks topping 5,000 feet, and is currently the biggest piece of real estate available anywhere in Texas. And it will set you back only $320 million. Dream bigger, wake up, the Texanist always says. What rewarding activities would the Texanist engage in if he had such a spread splayed out before him? Well, he might raise livestock, ride horses, farm, hunt, fish, camp, rodeo, watch sunsets, cook out, have friends over, stargaze, learn to play a mouth harp, drink whiskey out of a clear glass bottle, plant things, paint landscapes, watch sunrises, write poetry, swim in the buff, and be a good steward of his huge personal piece of Texas, or put more simply, just ranch a lot. While you're waiting for your cotton to get tall enough for you to be able to afford such a place, the Texanist would direct you to Farm, Texas Farm and Ranch, a publication affiliated with the Texas Monthly Mothership that showcases exceptional specimens of rural real estate that are up for sale. It's sometimes referred to around the office as ranch porn. Public service announcement, do not Google ranch porn. And it sounds like something that would be right up your alley. Maybe it will help tide you over until the day your Texas-sized dreams are finally realized. And when that happens, please be sure that you engage in one more traditional ranch activity that no self-respecting Texas landowner would deny himself, inviting Texas's self-described foremost advice columnist over for a long visit. Try to close out with this Texanist column from June, but we're running a little short of time, so hopefully we'll get right through it. It's entitled Dark Clouds and Silver Linings. It's a special note from the desk of the Texanist. He says, in the midst of the very strange times in which we currently find ourselves, the Texanist made the decision to deviate from his usual format of doling out fine advice and instead take this opportunity to look in on y'all and see how everything is going. Everybody okay? Texanist and his people are pretty good, knock on wood, and perhaps the same is true for you and yours. Unfortunately, Texanist is aware that this might not be the case. Time of this writing, June of this year, Texas Department of State Health Services reporting that 217 of 254 Texas counties had 35,390 cases of COVID-19 and a total of 973 fatalities. Business as usual has become quite unusual. For much of this still young year, the entire state has been at a standstill. Though the situation is changing, restaurants have been closed, bars have been closed, movie theaters have been closed, dance halls have been closed. All businesses deemed non-essential were shut down. Texanist, by the way, was classified as an essential worker, a fact that he finds both affirming and a little amusing. Not a whole heck of a lot the Texanist hadn't seen in all his many days on this earth, but he's never seen anything like this. Not by a long shot. Present state of affairs is downright surreal. Texanist is working from his home office, the missus has turned the kitchen into her home office, and the teenage girl Texanist is receiving her schooling over the internet in her home classroom, also known as her bedroom. It's a weird time indeed. And to put it mildly, it's not a good time. For many of our fellow Texans, it's very much a bad time. As noted, loved ones are getting sick, and sadly, some are dying. We lost country star Joe Diffie, who lived on and off in Texas during his younger years and was a staple of many a honky-tonk jukebox in his later years. We lost John Prine, who never lived in Texas, but was a favorite singer-songwriter of many Texas singer-songwriters. We lost playwright Terrence McNally, who grew up in Dallas, and Corpus Christi went on to win Tony Awards. We lost 97-year-old Bay City funeral home operator Eddie Roberts, veteran of World War II, who became Texas's first reported coronavirus fatality when he died on March 15th, and we've lost hundreds more since. On top of all of this, there's the unfathomable financial pain it's caused when normal life suddenly grinds to a halt. Texanist is lucky to be gainfully employed, but many of his friends and neighbors have suddenly found themselves in dire fiscal situations. Think about all the shopkeepers, restaurateurs, waiters, bartenders, bellhops, and housekeepers. Think about all the school cafeteria workers and the janitors and the out-of-work musicians. Think about the barbers and the bingo hall operators and the bowling alley attendants. The Texanist knows you've already thought about all these folks. Think about them for a minute longer. Let it soak in. There's hardly anyone who's gone untouched in some way, large or small, by our coronavirus conundrum. And oh yeah, on top of all that, the price of oil sank into negative territory for the first time ever, prompting a colleague to point out that for a moment there, a barrel of oil was cheaper than a six-pack of Lone Star. A bust seems to be nigh, which will make things even worse for many Texans. The messages from our leaders at every level of government have been confusing. Protocols and directives change at a head-spinning clip. People don't know what to do. The parks are open. The parks are closed. Churches are open for Sunday services, but gathering in groups of 10 or more is a bad idea. Don't wear a mask unless you're exhibiting symptoms. Everyone must wear a mask at all times. Don't use the walking trail in your neighborhood. Use the walking trail, but only in a clockwise direction while wearing a mask or not. Unsurprisingly, nerves are a bit frayed. Even after the all clear signal sounds and the Texans feels a perhaps misplaced confidence that it will someday sound, repercussions are going to be long lasting. How many businesses won't recover? How many workers won't go back to work? Will swimming pools reopen? Will summer camps reopen? Will there be a state fair of Texas? Has there ever not been a state fair? Answer, there was no state fair in 1918 because of World War I, and again from 1942 to 1945 because of World War II. What about county fairs and rodeos and cook-offs and conventions and all the rest? Is there even going to be a football season, be it high school, college, or professional? There are so many questions with no clear answers, and in the absence of good information, minds can wander to the gloomiest of scenarios. Yet despite all the darkness of the day, life's proverbial street still has its proverbial sunny side. It's where you'll find the Texanist and invites you to join him there, at a safe distance, of course. There is, after all, abundant reason to not lose hope or a sense of gratitude. Despite the health crisis and economic pandemonium and the actions of the panic-stricken toilet paper hoarders, Texanists still don't understand what's going on there. Scamming opportunists, wacky protesters, and the bossy know-it-alls on social media and in the online neighborhood groups, the reasons to maintain an optimistic outlook are plenty. Who hadn't noticed the striking uptick in neighborliness? The blocks are abuzz with streetwalkers. Not that kind. Get your mind out of the gutter. Texanist has been working with his windows open lately, and he regularly stops what he's doing to take notes of the bird chirping, squirrels making squirrel sounds, and children he's never even noticed before playing on the sidewalk below. Dogs are getting lots of love and giving it too. Lulu, the Texanist puffy and loyal three-legged bichon frise, seems even happier than her usual exceedingly happy self. Also, there's no traffic. Texanist was driving through downtown Austin just the other day, and where he once would have sat fuming, mired in a bog of fellow-fuming motorists at every red light, he instead encountered block upon block open road, adorned with perfectly synchronized green lights. No swarms of annoying scooters. He saw nary a one. Perhaps best of all, Texas has witnessed the advent of the to-go margarita, a glorious genie that the Texans believes might, fingers crossed, be hard to get back in the figurative bottle. All these good things have come out of very bad, certainly a salve for tattered nerves. They're also beginning to seem like something more, specifically a welcome reminder of a simpler, slower-paced Texas, far-off place that the Texans recalls from his small-town upbringing in the 60s and 70s. Back then, families gathered around a table for dinner every evening and had the time to take a leisurely walk around the neighborhood, stopping often to chew the fat. Back then, we looked at our grocery store checkers in the eyes and thanked them. Back then, a person could drive on I-35 or Loop 610 or Central Expressway unimpeded by maddening traffic jams. Texanist realized that there was actually never a time in the bygonest of areas when 610 was traffic-free, but let it go, he's on a roll. Texanist does not want to sound like Pollyanna. During this unusually anxious yet quiet time, we've also had to give up a slew of activities that are quintessentially Texan. Eating at a favorite Tex-Mex joint, say, or hitting a dance hall, or joining the revelers down at the local swimming hole. List goes on. Texans, after all, are a decidedly social, fun-loving lot. But even so, the Texans can't take the feeling that in recent weeks, as everything slowed down, we've been usefully reminded of something we didn't even realize that we'd forgotten about, something we lost as Texas has grown bigger and busier and hurlier and burlier and less like itself. The question whether the coronavirus will forever change the world is getting asked a lot these days. If the whopper of a query and one that the Texanist, a simple purveyor of advice, isn't equipped to answer definitively, but he has been thinking more and more that there's a pretty good chance that this pandemical pickle just might in some ways change Texas for the better. Maybe. Long after the all-clear signal has sounded, we'll remember the silver linings of these cloudy days, and maybe we'll choose to live the sorts of lives that will have Texas looking.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas. Followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Midland Health Department is providing clinical services by appointment only. Appointments will be scheduled from 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Health Department will have immunization clinics 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613.
Of all the interesting places in our country, the American West may just have the most interesting stories. Recording Library of West Texas volunteer Jack reads articles from Range, American Cowboy, and other publications on the Western Magazine Hour, Wednesday mornings at 11 and again Sunday afternoons at 5. On Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 63 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and a Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the December issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the Editor's Note by Emily Roberts Stone. The Promised Land. With fall in full swing and temperatures finally lowering, it's the perfect time to explore the bounty of landscapes we're lucky to enjoy in Texas. While we've all had our share of disappointment over disrupted plans and vacations in 2020, spending time in nature has been a balm to our weary souls. It's no surprise that Texans are opting to spend more time outdoors this year. In complimentary feature stories, writers Clayton Maxwell and Asher Albine embark on journeys through Texas's private and public lands, respectively, to highlight the diversity of outdoor options and the benefits of communing with nature. Both stories offer recommendations and tips for where and how to safely experience Texas's natural treasures. This issue also includes a partnership with Stranger's Guide, a quarterly magazine devoted to exploring destinations around the globe. Its special Texas edition is available at shop.strangersguide.com. For our joint feature story, writer-at-large Sarah Heppala visited Corsicana a half dozen times over 3 months to deliver a nuanced portrait of the town that has captured the country's imagination since Cheer debuted on Netflix in January. Sarah said she found herself charmed by the city she had previously bypassed on many road trips from her native Dallas. "The pandemic has made me more curious about the places nearby," she says. "It's one of the unexpected gifts of being forced to sit in place for so long. You start to really notice what's around you." While the holiday season is certain to be different for many of us this year, I hope the slower pace offers surprising rewards and deep breaths of fresh air. And next, I'll read Clayton Maxwell's article titled, "This Land is Your Land." Private land comprises the majority of Texas. Now, two online platforms offer the chance to get in touch with natural beauty previously inaccessible to the public. "I have sidestepped prickly pear and creosote to crest a rugged overlook, and my rewards are an endorphin surge and the sight of the turquoise Devil's River cleaving the canyon below. While standing on the rocky crag overlooking the Hudspeth River Ranch, just north of Comstock, I consider the words of Henry David Thoreau, 'In wildness is the preservation of the world.' In wildness, I would add, is also the preservation of our sanity. For me, this ranch is a reprieve from a world grappling with a pandemic. Like the winds that carry the buzzards over the river canyon, the wildness here is a thermal uplift for the spirit. I've booked a night at Hudspeth River Ranch via Explore Ranches, an online platform that offers guests overnight stays at top-tier private ranches in Texas, California, Colorado, and New Mexico. This year, when so many are seeking the solace and freedom of the outdoors due to COVID-19, Explore Ranches has received 9 times as many bookings as it did in 2019. Apparently, I'm not the only one craving a little wildness these days. The mental and physical benefits of just being outdoors for days without connection to our routines and electronics, that's why we started the business," says Jay Clayburgh, who co-founded Explore Ranches in 2018 with Allison Ryan and Jesse Womack. "We want to give people the opportunity to create some kind of connection to the outdoors and clean air and water, so they fall in love with and want to conserve those places." Explore Ranches is on the front wave of a vacation trend called land sharing. The trend is similar to short-term vacation rental, which platforms like Airbnb and VRBO excel at. Rather than staying in someone's house in town, you escape to remote locales that sometimes even a GPS can't find. Explore Ranches' properties tend to run more expensive due to the size of the accommodations and the various optional amenities. HipCamp is a good alternative platform for those seeking a more rough-hewn and economical trip. Launched in San Francisco in 2013, HipCamp offers properties spanning the country, with 3,000 locations in Texas. The accommodations range from campsites and cabins to yurts and RV spots. Once booked, the platform facilitates a connection with the landowner and handles details. Both platforms offer options state and national parks can't provide in Texas, where 95.8% of the 268,000 square miles that make up our state is privately owned, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. The rest is owned by local, state, and federal governments. It's a stark contrast to western states with similarly vast terrain. In New Mexico, Arizona, and Wyoming, over 50% of land is government-owned. Unlike these other states, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management is almost non-existent in Texas. The only Bureau property in Texas is the 12,000-acre Crossbar Management Area in the Panhandle, which is being restored to its natural shortgrass prairie ecosystem and not currently open to the public. So much off-limits land makes no trespassing signs ubiquitous, leaving outdoors enthusiasts imagining what lies beyond the barbed wire fences that crisscross the countryside. A far greater percentage of people in Texas don't have an opportunity to be in a true wilderness setting like in western states, says Mark Steinbach, executive director of Texas Land Conservancy, a nonprofit that helps landowners preserve the legacy of their land through conservation easements. Sure, there's access to city parks and, to a lesser degree, the state parks, but those are more manicured. In a state with so little public space, and where parks are particularly in demand during the pandemic, land sharing is a welcome new trend and one conservationists hope will also help preserve the land. As kids, Sarah and Abby Strunk sipped the waters that bubbled from the limestone creek bed on their family's Hudspeth River Ranch. They would scoop clear, clean water into their palms and taste the tang of water lilies and the earthiness of moss. Today, they help run the ranch in West Texas, where the waters of the Devil's River, arguably the most pristine in Texas, first emerge. During my overnight at the Hudspeth, I witness how the Strunk sisters have been shaped by their access to the remote land that's been in their family since 1905. They can easily maneuver a suburban over hair-raising low-water crossings, shoot an owdad across a canyon at 300 yards, and catch and clean a 21-inch smallmouth bass. Now in their late 20s, they understand how fortunate they were to roam these 15,000 acres throughout their childhood, and they would like to share it in the most respectful, responsible way. I realize that my childhood experience is not the norm, Sarah says. Unfortunately, such places are disappearing, and in order to preserve these treasures for future generations, we must share them with others. Sharing our place allows people to find a connection with the outdoors, and hopefully want to keep them around. The Hudspeth, which can sleep 10 guests, runs $650 a night per adult, with kids staying for free. Landowners have been leasing ranch land to hunters and outdoor sportsmen since the 1950s, and it's become an essential revenue stream. But Explore Ranches' model is different. It proffers a connection between owner and guest, one in which guests experience nature that is normally inaccessible, and owners generate income while educating and motivating others to help keep the land undeveloped. Clayberg, Explore Ranches' co-owner, has a personal connection to this mission. A member of the King Ranch family, he comes from a long line of conservationists. In 1934, his great-grandfather, U.S. Congressman and rancher Richard Clayburgh, authored the Federal Duck Stamp Law, which requires waterfowl hunters to purchase a stamp that now raises